From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, creating a corrupt, sadistic, rogue cop who has the TV audience rooting for him. We talk with Sean Ryan, creator and executive producer of the FX series The Shield. The show just began its seventh and final season. We also talk with stars Michael Chiklis, who plays rogue cop Vic Mackey, and CCH Pounder, who plays his boss. And True Blood is the new HBO series by Alan Ball, the man who brought us the hit series 6 Feet Under. It's also connected with the dead, or more accurately, the undead. We'll have a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. And I'm so burned out from watching 2 weeks of convention coverage, I can't tell you. Today on Fresh Air, we're going to step away from the politics, attacks, and fierce rivalries regarding the presidential contest and relax by wallowing in the politics, attacks, and fierce rivalries in the TV drama series The Shield. This cop show from the FX network began its seventh and final season this week, bringing to a boil an exciting and unpredictable story that has been simmering for years. Today we'll feature Terry's interviews with Michael Chiklis, who stars as rogue cop Vic Mackey, Sean Ryan, the writer-producer who created The Shield, and CCH Pounder, who co-stars as Vic's one-time colleague and current boss, who doesn't trust him at all. No wonder. Vic Mackey stunned audiences in the series pilot by shooting a fellow officer in cold blood. And this season, another member of his elite strike force, a guy named Shane, played by Walton Goggins, is becoming an increasingly deadly threat himself. Shane and Vic are circling each other, each aware of the other's darkest secrets and deadliest deeds. And every conversation is full of tension, anger, and suspicion.
Hey. Hey. You want to give me a clue what all this is about?
He's the key to defusing the Armenian time bomb you laid at my family's doorstep. He's the keeper of the intel the Mexis are using to blackmail their way to the top. Or was, till I helped myself.
And you made it look like this prick sold out to the Armos.
Which lit the fuse for the blood feud we're stirring up between Razin and the Mexicans.
Nicely done.
Aaron Bullers is the only one who could put my face to the grab.
So he's got to go away.
I need you to hook him up with the coyotes we were using to get Lem set up down in Mexico.
Who's he working for?
I want him gone by tomorrow night.
Look, getting him out of country's not a problem. Setting him up on a goat farm with money and contacts, it would be nice to know who and what I'm dealing with.
Working with you to protect my family, I'm down with that. Trusting you. Not there yet.
Vic Mackey is a character who is both charismatic and terrifying. He gets confessions out of suspects by beating and torturing them. Yet on this show, he's still, somehow, sympathetic. Terry spoke with Michael Chiklis last year and asked him what it was like to film scenes in which he had to convincingly pretend to torture another actor.
From a playing standpoint, it can be quite miserable, to tell you the truth, Terry. I mean, you know, you're in a room for 12 hours with an actor that you really, really like hanging by a chain, and you're slashing him with albeit a fake chain, but, you know, you want to make it viable and everything, and it's all about a trust exercise and as actors being able to give each other permission.
How does this affect your relationship with that actor? Do you feel, you know, bad about putting him through it?
Well,
do you ask him every often in between takes, is this okay for you? Am I hurting you?
Yes, it's fraught with apologies, and, you know, it really is. You just can't help but look at a guy and just go, oh, man, listen, for what is about to happen to you, I am truly sorry, you know, what you're about to go through. And I mean, like I said, you have to, it's a weird sort of bonding where you're excited as actors because you know the material is great. And there's a potential, at least before you even start shooting, for a great piece of drama.
Do you have like a safe word? So if things, do you know what I mean?
Well,
something.
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes it depends. Yes, it depends on the scene. I don't recall exactly what it was on that scene, but yes, you have safe words. You can just say. Usually, it's stop. You know, but sometimes the guy it would sound too much like in the context of the scene, so he'll say. Usually, it comes in the form of saying the real actor's name. You know, they'll say like, Chiklis, stop, you know, and that'll jar you and go, wait, okay, now we're in the real world here, you know. So you have to, you know, you have to create those barriers before you even start.
How familiar were you with the multi-ethnic inner city streets of L.A. that Vic Mackey works?
Oh, I wasn't really, honestly. That's been a big eye opener for me. I'm. You know, I knew a little bit about it because I was involved with and have been involved with the Children's Life-Saving Foundation, which I'm the spokesperson for, which is a wonderful charity that helps with children who are in homeless shelters in the Los Angeles County area. So I had been to shelters, I had visited certain areas, but we shoot in some of the hardest core neighborhoods in Los Angeles, whether it's in Rampart or East LA or in Compton. And I really didn't know that there were places like this in the United States of America, that there a downright third world, just abject poverty. And it's been a very eye-opening experience, and you find yourself really, really appalled. And I find myself, oftentimes driving, into my beautiful home and, looking at my wife and children and just having such a far more deeper respect and appreciation of the world and my life and so many things.
So you actually shoot on location? On street.
Yes. Yes. 99% of my show is in location. We have one working set, which originally was on location as well. It was the church, which was converted into a precinct. That was originally, in the pilot, that is a live location. But they replicated it on a soundstage, and that's the only stationary set that we have. Everything else, pretty much, we shoot on location. But as far as the neighborhood's concerned, when we first started shooting down there, we had a couple of odd encounters where, one night we had a crew from a major L.A. gang show up and say, "Hey, what are you doing here?" We were like, "We're shooting." And they said, "Oh, no, you're not. You haven't paid rent, So we had to work out a little arrangement and get permission to shoot there.
You've directed several episodes of The Shield, in addition to starring in the series. First of all, I want to play a scene from an episode that you directed. And this is a scene, you're not in this scene. This is a scene where, Captain Aceveda has been raped was forced to perform sex on the guy who raped him.
Yeah.
And he's very, broken up and ashamed about it. He hasn't told his wife. His wife knows that something's wrong because he hasn't been behaving like a husband. And there's a scene in which she confronts him, and he just kind of breaks down and confesses. And she doesn't accept it. She doesn't accept that he allowed this rape to happen.
Yeah.
It's a terrific scene. Can you talk about directing it? It's a really important turning point in the character of Captain Aceveda.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you have to be particularly sensitive to the actor's process. A lot of it boils down to trust. If your actors really know that you're on their side and you want them to flourish and you want them to be able to be accessible and touch that pool of emotion. I mean, that's a very, very deep scene, and it doesn't take the turn that one might expect it to. When you have someone like Benito Martinez, who's a very heterosexual, proud father and husband, having to sort of face that potential sort of humiliation and rejection, you have to talk to him and allow him to feel comfortable enough to touch that pool and go to that place. It's a very ugly, dark place.
So can you talk about what you did to make everybody feel safe to get out these emotions, or what advice, if any, you gave the actors in this scene?
With Benny, I just basically said to him, "Hey, Benny, I know this is tough, man, but you got to go there." And he's like, he knew it. And I said, "Listen, we're going to be here till we get it. So just know that, don't feel any pressure that you have to get it in a few takes here. Do what you need to do and get to the place you need to get to." And that allows an actor to go, "Okay, look, I'm 9 times out of 10, that'll give an actor enough latitude to go through their process and get where they need to go."
So why don't we hear that scene from an episode of The Shield directed by Michael Chiklis. And this is Benito Martinez as Captain Aceveda and Camille Sands as his wife. And she's about to find out that he was raped.
Those guys I fought. One of them assaulted me.
But you're okay now.
They tied my hands. They made me get on my knees.
They made you? Both of them?
Just one of them.
You didn't? Oh. Hey, you're a cop. You're trained
no,
in...
I was alone. I was...
No, David. How could you let that happen?
Because I wanted to live. I wanted to live for you and Sophia.
I can't talk about this here.
It's a scene from The Shield, directed by my guest Michael Chiklis, who plays Detective Vic Mackey on the series. He's the star of the show. Your father ran a hair salon or a barber shop?
Yeah.
Which was it? Was it
a beauty salon?
Beauty
yeah.
salon for women.
Unisex. It was unisex beauty salon.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. He, you know, he's a very interesting guy. My father. He's very sort of macho kind of a guy. Very old school, New England Greek guy by heritage. That is, American by birth, by the way, and he's primarily retired at this point. He's sort of semi-retired and just watches the books.
Does he approve of you shaving your head?
Well, you know, what he didn't approve of is what I did to my hair. When I, little anecdote here, I played a 65-year-old man in college, Mr. DePina, in You Can't Take It With You, and I shaved my head in male patent baldness at 20 years old. And instead of being smart and using powder on my head, I used Ben Nye grease paint like I did on my face and didn't remove it properly. I would just use soap and water, and it essentially killed the follicles on my head. So
my hair never
grew back the same. Yeah, it was a very traumatic experience as a young actor. And it actually kind of was shaped my career in a lot of ways. It's interesting what happened.
Because you had an older man's hair.
Yeah.
Line.
Yeah, I was, yeah, yeah. So I was sort of forced to, you know, either start wearing hair pieces, which I did in Wired. I wore a hair piece on top of my head during Wired, ironically enough, or to sort of just be the person that I was, and, you know, and that's what I wore. I wore my hair normally, you know, on the commission. It was really just a train wreck of a hair situation for me. and it was very traumatic for a while. But, you know, I have no regrets because it very much shaped my career, which has been very sort of interesting and eclectic. And I'm glad.
Michael Chiklis speaking with Terry Gross last year. Coming up, S.H.I.E.L.D. creator Sean Ryan. This is Fresh Air. Sean Ryan not only created The Shield, but has stayed aboard as executive producer since its premiere in 2002. In preparation for planning this seventh and final season, he went back and watched all the old episodes of The Shield. There was no need, though, for Sean Ryan to revisit the previous cop series he had written, Nash Bridges, the CBS series starring Don Johnson. Terry Gross spoke to Sean Ryan in 2006, and he told her Nash Bridges was much more of an entertainment show than a realistic portrayal of police work.
That was very much a hero show. So Don Johnson's character, Nash, you know, really couldn't screw up very badly. He always had to have the right intentions. You know, so if something went bad, it wasn't because, you know, any human foible of his caused it to go bad. And, you know, the shows, you know, ended happily. The crimes were always solved. And he was a straight up hero. And you know, if there was any problem with Nash, it was that he just couldn't quite make whatever his current relationship with a beautiful woman quite work out because he couldn't commit. That, you know, that was like the one big character flaw, quote unquote. And you know, it was a very successful show. It ran for 6 years, and that's the way that show needed to be for what it was. But you know, there was a hierarchy that, you know, Nash was the one that needed to solve the crimes. He was the one that needed to swoop in at the last second. You know, one of his underlings was never the one that, you know, was the hero of the day and would save it. So it was those kinds of things, and especially the intentions. You know, these were cops to look up to, and you know, and they always had everyone's, you know, they always had the innocent public's best interests at heart.
Okay, now you can't say that happens in The Shield. I mean, some of the cops at the center of The Shield, particularly the star of the show, the character played by Michael Chiklis, I mean, he's not only corrupt, he's kind of sadistic. He really enjoys violence. He
has a few flaws. You know, I wanted to write in the gray areas. You know, I'd written a very black and white show for 3 years and been successful doing it, and the show was successful. And it was my job to, you know, to service my bosses and presenting them with the material that they wanted, and I worked hard to do that. There were just a lot of sacred cows. You know, for instance, on almost every TV cop show I'd seen in the 90s or in the late 80s, the heroes would be like the detectives, and the boss, the captain, would be a minority. And it was television's way of saying, you know, well, we acknowledge that it's a multi-ethnic universe, but we're not going to sort of put them forefront. And additionally, our minority captain is going to be above reproach and, you know, isn't going to have a bad quality at all. I looked at Edward James Olmos' character in Miami Vice. I looked at James McDaniel's character in NYPD Blue, Yaphet Kotto's character in Homicide. All these shows sort of had this thing. And so my first thing was, well, you know what? I'm going to have a minority captain, but everyone's going to hate him. and everyone's going to think that he's a quota baby that got the job, you know, because of his race, not because of his talent. And not everyone's going to look up to him.
You know, you're talking about trying to break the rules of some of the shows that you really admired. Now, in shows like Homicide and Law and Order, there's some like fabulous interrogation scenes, and you really admire how well these cops, how brilliant some of these cops are at interrogating. In the pilot, and excuse me for going all the way back to the pilot, but you know, although I've been watching the series for some time, I never saw the pilot until last night on DVD. So it's really a brilliant episode. It's like maybe the best pilot I've ever seen. But anyways, there's three separate interrogation scenes in that, and each of them are really different. Each of them serves a different dramatic purpose and reveals something different about the person doing the interrogating. Would you just talk about how you used each of those interrogation scenes to do a whole lot of dramatic work?
Yeah, Homicide, like I said, Homicide really was my favorite show, and I was always impressed with their interrogation scenes, especially the ones involving Andre Brower's character. And really what I took from that show was that interrogation scenes in good dramas are about the detectives. They're not about finding out the truth of a case. They're not about just furthering plot. So I wanted to find out, you know, Dutch has a few scenes with this pedophile where he just goes along and sort of shows empathy for, you know, for how you can be attracted to young girls. And it showed the sort of gamesmanship and mindset that he was willing to get into to break this guy. And then we had, you know, a very sort of infamous scene with Vic Mackey and another pedophile kidnapper near the end, and we saw just sort of how ruthless he could be. But those scenes were designed to get into the characters of our detectives and find out who they are, which are far more interesting interrogation scenes than just browbeating people until they tell you that they did it.
Well, yeah, and you know, Dutch, the cop who's interrogating the the child molester, the first time he really gets into the guy's head, and he's basically saying, say, do you believe there's a gay gene? Do you believe that, like, people are born gay? Well, if people are born gay, maybe people are born to be child molesters, too. I mean, I understand. I understand what you're going through. And that's very effective. But then he does it again on another child molester, and the child molester's attitude is like, hey, I know the game you're playing, and it's not going to work on me. I'm smart, too.
Yeah.
And then the third time, like, Vic Mackey, the Michael Chiklis character, goes in and just, like, beats the confession out of him. And the contrast between those three interrogation scenes is so interesting dramatically and in what they reveal about each of the characters.
Yeah, there's a time for each of them, I think. And you know, what I was really trying to get at is that, yes, it is tempting to resort to brute behavior at times, and sometimes it can be even effective, but is that what we want? And what I wanted through the other story, through the interrogation with Pedophile, is to see how it's tempting to give law enforcement people sort of unlimited power to do anything to solve these heinous crimes, because there's a slippery slope at the end of it, because when you give them power to act on your behalf, don't be surprised when they take that power to act on their own behalf.
Sean Ryan, creator of The Shield, speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. We'll continue their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of The Good Thief, a novel set in 19th century New England about the adventures of an orphan boy named Wren, by Hannah Tinty, author of Animal Crackers. From the Music Performance Fund, striving to enrich lives by sponsoring thousands of public concerts in the United States. Schedules at musicpf.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Sean Ryan, creator and producer of The Shield. Also, we hear from actress CCH Pounder, who co-stars in the show. And I'll review Alan Ball's new HBO series, True Blood. His previous series was 6 Feet Under. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. The FX police drama series The Shield just began its seventh and final season. And today, we're featuring several of Terry's Shield-related interviews. Right now, we're continuing Terry's conversation with Sean Ryan, who created the series. In Season 5, Forrest Whitaker guest starred as an investigator with Internal Affairs. He was looking into whether Vic Mackey killed a cop on his strike team after learning that cop was cooperating with Internal Affairs on a corruption investigation aimed at Vic and his crew. In this scene, Whitaker is interrogating Mackey's ex-wife. The actress is Kathy Ryan, who, in real life, is married to Sean Ryan.
Remember Terry Crawley? Sure, he was on Vic's team.
Do you remember any change in Vic's behavior leading up to Terry's death?
No, but he was pretty torn up afterwards. We all were.
I'm sure it was terrible. Terry was working for Justice, investigating your ex-husband's team for corruption, planting evidence, extortion, kickbacks, laundry list of things. When Vic made Terry as working for the feds, we believe that he and Shane Vendrell murdered him.
That's a lot of things, but he's no killer.
Because he's a survivor, he'll do whatever it takes to protect himself, his team, and his family. Are you really trying to tell me that after 12 years of marriage, you don't think that that man is capable of pulling the trigger on someone who's trying to take away everything from him? Everything?
You need to stop it.
Don't cry. I don't want to see you shed one single tear. Because tears imply that you didn't know. And don't you sit here and tell me that you didn't know, Mrs. Mackey.
A clip from season 5 of The Shield, when actor Forrest Whitaker was a season-long guest star on the show. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with Sean Ryan, creator and executive producer of The Shield.
Forrest Whitaker is just really extraordinary in his performances each week. And, you know, at first he's really kind of ingratiating and likable to the people who he wants on his side, who he wants to win over. And then he could just, like, on a dime, just, like, turn around and be, like, so just kind of tough and mean and unpleasant.
Manipulative. And,
and what?
Yeah, manipulative.
Manipulative, exactly. Manipulative, yeah. But
well, what you have is you have a guy who's an internal affairs detective who plays by the rules, who's trying to bust a cop who killed another cop and who beat suspects, and yet who does our audience root for? they still root for Vic, and they have found themselves justifying that by really hating Kavanaugh, the character that Forrest Whitaker plays. And it's been fascinating for me to watch. And what's been so unique about this, I mean, you know, it's easy to get bored after a number of years working on a TV show if you're writing the same thing. And we're always looking for what's something new to write. And what has been fascinating for us is we have this great anti-hero in Vic Mackey, you know, who you root for some of the times, root against other times. You know, you like what he's doing, then you don't like what he's doing. But we've brought in this character played by Forrest, who I've heard somebody term him as an anti-villain. He's trying to destroy your hero. He's doing what he can to do that. And yet, under most circumstances, he would be the hero and Vic would be the villain in almost any other piece. And so we've been able to sort of take him and show his flaws and show his good side and his ugly side. And yet it's completely turned around for the audience. You know, people want Vic Mackey to get away with this. And it's just intriguing for me to see that.
Now, you were explaining before how when you worked on Nash Bridges, there were certain rules as a writer that you had to follow to keep the character consistent and to keep him appropriately heroic. And you broke a lot of those rules when you created your series, The Shield. Does The Shield have its own rules that you have to present to new writers who come on board?
Yeah. There are certain things you don't want to box them in too much. You know, what's interesting is that no matter, and this really is a credit to Michael Chiklis, who plays Vic. You know, Michael has such charisma and is so likable that what I've found over the years is there's almost nothing that we can have Vic do that many of our viewers won't find a way to forgive him or apologize for him. And I found that fascinating. They will, you know, the audience has become an enabler of Vic Mackey in that they will provide the excuse for why he had to do something for which there really is no excuse. And it's one of the reasons why in this current season, this fifth season that we only have, as we talk, we only have two more episodes still left to air. I wanted to bring back that murder. The one, you know, people and viewers, I think, had sort of driven it to the back of their mind. And he's done so many good things and closed so many cases and brought so many violent criminals to justice, you know, in the interim, that it's easy to sort of forget that, well, yes, but this guy also did this and, you know, wanted to bring that back to life.
Sean Ryan, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry. Thank you very much.
Sean Ryan, creator of The Shield, speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. Coming up, actress CCH Pounder, who plays Claudette Wims on the show. This is Fresh Air. As the seventh season of The Shield began this week on the FX network, CCH Pounder's character of Claudette Wims, an honest cop who used to work alongside Vic, is enjoying her second year as Vic's boss. Well, maybe enjoying is the wrong word. She knows that Vic and his strike team are dirty and brutal, and has known for a long time. Much earlier in the series, before she was the captain, she interrogated a vicious drug dealer who has huge burns across one side of his face, from the burner of an electric stove. He's tough, but she's tough, too.
You've got a lot on your plate. Where'd you find the time? Drug trafficking. Consolidating a Mexican power base. Murder. Am I leaving anything out? Oh, yeah. Juvenile rape.
So you say.
Let's hope that genius IQ means you know how to help yourself. We've got you on tape making a death threat.
That could be anyone's voice. I'll challenge it in court.
What about the testimony of a cop with his own grill mark? You're gonna challenge that, too? What happened to your face? It used to be so pretty.
I'll only give my confession to Detective Mackey.
You don't make demands, not to me.
Actress CCH Pounder first became known for her starring role in the 1988 film Baghdad Cafe. Terry Gross spoke with CCH Pounder in 2006, when Pounder had just learned her S.H.I.E.L.D. character of Claudette was about to be promoted to captain.
That must be really good news, not only for your character, but for you as an actress, because you're going to be at the center of the show.
Well, actually more for my public, because I was trying to be captain for quite a while, this character, and when I didn't get it the first time and Glenn Close's character got it, I tell you, the news, the letters, the emails were amazing. I had no idea that it would have such an impact, but it went to the bottom line of American racism and how
really? Like
people
they gave it
perceive
to a white
themselves.
Actress, that kind of
Absolutely.
Thing?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Oh, I couldn't believe it. And, you know, you really forget that out in the world there, somehow it translates to a sort of a real place for many, many people. So that was about being shoved aside just like it is in the real world, and people were quite angry and very pissed off. And so they have been sending letters going, if they don't give you that job, I'm gonna, if they don't do that, and they were very clear. I'm leaving the blanks out, but
right.
They were very clear about how they felt.
Now, I wasn't sure you'd make it through this last season. You know, we've learned that your
right.
character has lupus. You collapsed, and things weren't looking good. I wasn't even sure you were going to come back. Did you worry that you were going to be written out?
Well, I had suggested that if I had suggested in season 5 that perhaps Claudette should just boil off, because I get frustrated when brilliant people or bright people or fairly intelligent people cannot take one particular person down. How do you dismantle someone like a Vic Mackey? And they keep coming up with fairly clever reasons for me to stay. And one of the things in the very beginning, I always felt that perhaps Claudette was the one that would take Vic Mackey down, and now it might not necessarily be that. But in looking to my character's future, I always thought, well, if she took him down, how would she do it? And just, dear God, just don't let him be shot in the streets. I want to have him dismantled. And that's one of the big challenges I've had, is having intelligent people around us and that man still surviving.
And Vic Mackey is the leader of the strike force. And, I mean, he's corrupt. He and his men, they take money from the drug dealers. They beat up suspects to get information. And you're one of the people on the show who is not intimidated by him at all. Why isn't your character intimidated by him?
I think Claudette's already been through her baptism by fire simply by being perhaps one of the earlier black women on the force, sort of female, black, those sort of parameters of the setup of becoming a detective, going through what's required in a very all-boys network for the most part, has got a tough outer layer, treats herself as one of the guys, and doesn't make exceptions for anyone. And she's got a moral code that's very clear at the moment, how she's written, and has not been challenged. She's not had it challenged by anyone so far.
Now, one of the things that your character has is a piercing look. She can almost like look through people when she's talking to them. Is that something you can do in real life when you need to?
Apparently. And I'm not really aware of it. But my husband says the same thing. It's like, whoa, what is that about? So apparently I've had it for a long time, too.
How did you get the part on The Shield?
Clark Johnson, the director of the pilot, I had just finished doing Boycott with him. I had one of the best experiences in filmmaking where, once again, I guess this is says a lot about me, I had no idea what the next shots would be. Even though as a veteran actor, you kind of figure it out fairly soon. Okay, they're going to do that setup, and then it's going to be this, that, and the other. But with Clark Johnson, I had absolutely no idea where the camera was sometimes and how we were going to do the shot. And I found it very exciting. And so I said to him, I don't care what you're doing next. Please, could I work with you again? We did have a wonderful time. Anyway, eventually he called me and he said, well, the next thing is sort of seven guys and a blonde, so no luck. And I went, okay, fine. I mentioned it to my agent, Judy Page, brilliant woman, who said, well, why can't you be one of the guys? And so I went, well, I don't know how to do that. And so she just made the arrangements. And I went up with several gentlemen. I was the only woman there. And I got the role that way.
So you read for a part that was written for a man.
Yes. And it was written in the male vernacular. And in that testosterone-driven sound. But he was an old sort of gumshoe, had been around the block quite a few times, and he was on his way to retirement, and I read that role. And I remember Scott Brazil, who was our executive producer, I said to him, well, it was kind of masculine. If you let me come back and read again, I'll decide what sex I want to be, because I think I suddenly got a really low voice and I was trying something. And they said, no, it was actually pretty interesting. So
the part was rewritten for a woman?
Almost. One of my requests was is that they didn't rewrite it for a woman. It was to write the woman as one of the boys. And I think that's what gives Claudette her edge, is that sort of no-nonsense, that tiny lack of sympathy for people really helps her sort of portray herself as one of the guys, and therefore a person to be reckoned with, and certainly somebody that Vic Mackey would not cross the line over, especially when you see him in this series with other women.
Now, in addition to your regular part on The Shield, you've done a lot of the crime shows. You've done Law and Order and Cagney and Lacey and Hill Street Blues. And I mean, have you done a lot of victims and you know, perps on those shows?
In the beginning, I did. In the beginning, I was the sniveling wife with the crying baby, selling crack for medication for her children, or being accosted by her husband, abused by her husband. I spent a couple of years literally just crying on cue. And I think it was actually Miami Vice Miami Vice, I played a mother on crack who sold her child for crack cocaine. And at the end of it, I had a marvelous time, by the way, in terms of acting. I had a great time. And at the end of it, I looked back and I went, I never want to do this again. Because I had by this time discovered how powerful television really, really is. Television is this incredibly powerful medium that people blur the lines between reality and fiction and take it as gospel. So I decided that after that, I'm going to play some women of worth, of character, of strength, of authority, educated, because the people who were watching me needed to see something that was far more uplifting than what I had been doing.
So what did you do, like sit home and wait for people to offer you uplifting roles?
I did, and I starved for about a year and a half. And I remember distinctly calling my agent and saying, okay, well, I'm really sort of 6 cents in the cookie jar now. So whatever comes next, I'm going to have to take it. And it was a script for not Law and Order, L.A. Law, the very first one, L.A. Law. And I got the entire script, and there was a miserable little person that I was meant to read for. And then there was the character of the judge, and I said, I want to read for the judge. And I was told that no black woman had read for the judge yet, and they didn't think they would let you in to do it. And I insisted, and my agents backed me up. And I went and read for the judge, and they were all like, oh, wow, I guess, yeah, she could be a judge. She could be a judge. Their black judges aren't there. That was one of the quotes I heard in the room. They are black judges, aren't there? I mean, that are women. And somebody said, I'll look it up. I remember a young kid. And I got that job.
Well, you know, since we were talking about different accents before and different voice placements, I'm wondering, like, in your years as a victim on TV shows, mm-hmm. on crime shows, was there a certain kind of voice that you would use for that?
Well, it was kind of always high and kind of whiny, and then I'm not quite sure where she went, but she was over there, and I had the children down. They were like down two stairs, and I just don't know where they are right now. But it was kind of like that, an endless parade of that. So you know, after a while, you got really nasally.
And now, in your role on The Shield, you use a very deep version of your voice,
right? I like the professionalism of that. I like the fact that...
it's power, isn't it?
Yes, yes. It is a maleness that I don't have physically, but I try to ground that maleness, that boys' club, in the sound of her voice. And by doing so, she gets almost instant authority and... I'm always trying to lose weight, and they're always happy when I'm heftier. So it's sort of that sort of hefty look with the deep voice and piercing eyes is like, yes, that's Claudette Wims. But, you know, it's part of human nature that we certainly recognize signage, and that really is signage.
CCH Pounder speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. The Shield has just started showing its final batch of episodes. To wrap up our Shield package, here's a little more of Terry's interview with the star of The Shield, Michael Chiklis.
So how do you think you're going to feel when The Shield ends?
Oh, you had to ask me that question. You know, right now, it's like the five stages of death. I'm in denial at the moment. You know, I'm really, yeah. I have to be in denial because I actually have to put my best foot forward and really do the best work that I can come up with for this coming year.
Yeah.
But I know it's going to be very, very hard. It's going to be very sad. Again, it's been one of the most extraordinary experiences in my life. And, you know, one thing that I can say that I'm really happy about is that it's not going to be a situation where I wake up 10 years from now and go, wow, I really didn't appreciate what that was when it was happening.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I'm very proud of is that my wife and I have known from day one what this was and how great it's been and how sweet it's been. And you know what? I don't want to be a person to move forward in my life and sort of rest on that laurel. I'm so thrilled to move forward. I feel like there's so many wonderful characters to play. And I'm really, really actually excited at the Brave New World aspect of it.
I'll be really sorry to see The Shield end. I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been a pleasure.
Oh, Terry, thank you. Right back at you.
Michael Chiklis talking to Terry Gross in 2007. Coming up, I review True Blood, the new vampire drama series from HBO. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com and broadcasting and cable magazine. Ever since The Sopranos cut to black, HBO has been searching for the next big thing. The show that replaced it, John from Cincinnati, sure wasn't it. Not only was that David Milch series a big disappointment, but its appearance meant the disappearance of Milch's Deadwood, the HBO series that at the time was the best drama on television. Showtime, meanwhile, captured lots of attention and deserved every drop of it with Dexter, its creepy, funny, bloody drama about a serial killer who kills other serial killers. So it makes sense that HBO, which was in need of a creative transfusion anyway, went with its own creepy, funny, bloody drama series and went back to one of its successful producers, Alan Ball, who had spent years on 6 Feet Under, surrounded by death and the dead. Now, in True Blood, which premieres Sunday, he's surrounded by death and the undead. Adapted from a series of novels by Charlaine Harris, True Blood is set in a small Louisiana town, small enough to be near both bayous and rundown plantation mansions. It's based on the premise that vampires, 2 years earlier, finally admitted they were real, not myth, and started to mainstream into regular society. They came out of the coffin, as one character describes it, because of the invention of a synthetic blood that could sustain vampires so they no longer had to drink human or animal blood. They can even go into bars and diners and order some, which is just what one vampire does in the opening episode of True Blood. His name is Bill, he's played by Stephen Moyer, and he's served by Sookie, a charming young waitress played by Anna Paquin. Sookie has her own secrets and hidden strengths. She's telepathic, for one thing. But Sookie can't hear Bill's thoughts at all. So when he enters Sam's diner, she knows he's different. And she's not scared. She's fascinated. And as excited as a preteen girl meeting a Jonas brother.
Hi, what can I get for you tonight?
Do you have any of that synthetic bottled blood?
No, I'm so sorry. Sam got some a year ago, but nobody ever ordered it, so it went bad. You're our first vampire.
Am I that obvious?
I knew the minute you came in. Can't believe nobody else around here seems to.
He does.
Oh, don't worry about Sam. He's cool. I know for a fact he supports the Vampire Rights Amendment.
How progressive of him.
Well... anything else you drink?
Actually, no. But you can get me a glass of red wine so I have a reason to be here.
Well, whatever the reason, I'm glad you are.
If you were a fan of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and I hope you were, you're already comfortable with the idea of mixing terror and humor in a vampire story. Buffy was better, and actually a lot more subtle, but True Blood approaches things differently. Buffy, like a David Lynch drama, was about finding darkness hidden in the sunniest of places. It was set, after all, in Sunnydale. And more than anything else, Buffy was about the epic, endless struggle between good and evil. True Blood has other things on its mind. It's big on allegory, and the tension about accepting vampires into society is an obvious play on civil rights in general and gay rights in particular. Sometimes too obvious, but it's interesting anyway. Even better is the idea that just as vampires can feed on humans, certain humans in True Blood like to feed on vampires. They either seek them out as exciting, dangerous sexual partners, or synthesize vampire blood as a potent new black market drug. So while some outlaw vampires continue to hunt humans, there are some outlaw humans hunting vampires, while others, like Sookie and Bill, just want to get along. But what chance do you have to love one another till death do you part when loving a vampire means it's death at the start? True Blood explores that question, and others, in a show that builds, slowly but surely. Stay with it for a few episodes, and you'll be craving your weekly dose of True Blood. It's not going to replace The Sopranos, but as a synthetic substitute, it'll do for now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Hirschfeld. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from Disney Channel. Playhouse Disney's new original series, Imagination Movers, is premiering this Saturday at 10 a.m., 9 Central, on Playhouse Disney. From Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, why the U.S. needs to take the lead on solving global warming and how the challenge could help revive America at home and abroad. We talk with New York Times foreign affairs columnist Thomas Friedman. His new book is called Hot, Fat, and Crowded. Also, J.J. Abrams, co-creator of the TV series Lost, tells us about his new TV series, Fringe. Join us for the next Fresh Air.